Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This election cycle has been notable for many things, including the revelations from hacked private email servers made public by WikiLeaks. The emails have been the source of several stories published by major news outlets, but U.S. intelligence agencies have blamed Russians for the initial hacks, that has some journalists concerned about the ethics of using the WikiLeaks materials. Others defend the practice, saying it is a matter of free speech and public information. Backchannel.com editor Stephen Levy last week wrote about the conflict in an article with the headline, "When Journalists Align with Thieves." He joins us now by phone. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
A lot of people believe that WikiLeaks publishes the hacked information with the hopes that the media picks it up and publicizes it. So how does that factor into the morality argument here?
Well, you're right. This clearly is the intent, it seems, of whoever did purloin those emails or hack into them, in the case of the DNC. And the United States Intelligence Agency thinks it's the Russians trying to affect our elections. On the other hand, journalists are hardwired to present the news wherever they can get it. And it is not illegal to mine these publicly available now emails. But there is, a consideration to say, well, wait a minute, are we acting as stooges for people who committed a crime to make those available?
Yeah, you compare the Watergate scandal to the two document dumps provided to WikiLeaks, and you said that in 1972, journalists brought down a presidency by exposing the theft of political information. Now they use the contents of the stolen documents to pursue their own ends. It's interesting because I'm from the generation that was inspired by the whole Watergate journalism.
Right, right. I went back and reread some of the book by Woodward and Bernstein, mm-hmm. All the President's Men, and it talked about just the amazing amount of shoe leather they spent figuratively to get at what was going on when the Republicans tried to break into the Democratic organization and then uncovered all sorts of other dirty tricks as they're called. In this case, journalists don't have to spend any shoe leather. They just open up their browsers and have a complete archive of the goings-on of the Democratic National Committee, and they not only can search through it, it's like a little mini Google, and find out the questions that have been bothering them, the questions they wanted answers to, but also the most like mundane things, and also they're able to get a picture behind the scenes as if they were surveilling the Democratic National Committee there. So I have to say, as a journalist, I'm totally fine with them looking at the questions we've all been asking, like what did Hillary Clinton say in those highly paid speeches to the banks, to Goldman Sachs and places like that. And then there are the other things, which aren't such big scoops, but actually got more prominence because they have that extra little thrill of being purloined, of coming from private emails. And one case that I thought was striking was there was a story describing the relationship between the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, and the Clinton campaign there. And it was something which was sort of an inside politics kind of thing that normally would be buried in the paper, but because there was emails describing some of the tension, that became lifted. And then there were like totally mundane things, like the Washington Post did a story, they found an email by John Podesta to his wife saying, "Gee, the Metro was all busy today. I couldn't get into the White House. Can you pick me up and take me there?" He said to his wife there, which is something that doesn't seem terribly newsworthy. But again, because it was stolen, hey, why not? Why not write about this?
Well, there is that question. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the ethics of publishing as journalism, the documents released by WikiLeaks, the two big dumps regarding the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. My guest is Stephen Levy, editor at backchannel.com. He has written about this recently. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Stephen Levy, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. So, Stephen, is there a point that which the documents, some of them are valuable, some of them matter, and some of them don't? Or are you saying from stem to stern, it's a slippery slope?
Well, I think it is a slippery slope. And to be honest, I don't have a great answer for this. This is why I couch this really as an opening to the discussion with the back channel readers. We publish on the Medium platform. It's really easy to respond to this. And I was curious what other people thought. Mm-hmm. As a journalist, I welcome the availability of information there. But I do have to say, it doesn't feel good to go through these, things. These were not intended for public consumption. These were, in the case of John Podesta, they were, in a lot of cases, they were like private emails. I liken it in a sense to the hack that came with the Sony Corporation, where all the corporate correspondence was, exposed there. And likewise, WikiLeaks published it. You could search through it. Actually, I don't know if it was WikiLeaks, but a different hacker there. It was anonymous. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
In that case, not only could you find out like very gossipy things about what the executives thought of this movie star or that, but a lot of their personal correspondence was wrapped in there too. I have to admit, I searched for my own name to see did I come up in that and found something. I felt a little bad about it. I really wasn't supposed to.
So. Is there any distinction to be made between leaked documents like this and the product of espionage?
Well, in this case, I think you could say it was the product of espionage. So some people look back to the Pentagon Papers there, and those papers, again, were stolen. They were government papers, maybe. So I think there is a distinction there between something that is the property of the public that the government doesn't want you to see, as opposed to something that is private. Even the workings of a political party are private. In the Sony case, it's a corporation. But I think the larger issue here, and the reason why I think this is important beyond this, is that all our correspondence, most of it takes place on these web services like Gmail, and are vulnerable. And the question is, what as a society are we going to do? Are we to assume now that when we communicate with each other, that it is essence public because there's a chance that it will be exposed and people will get hold of that? What if someone got hold of all Google's mail, and sort of downloaded many terabytes of it, and then said, okay, you can go search through it, and everyone's mail is available there. What would happen then?
You also wonder how much resources go into sifting through these emails that aren't going into talking about the policies of the candidates and that sort of thing.
Well,
it's
kind of shifting
resources.
Well, there is shifting resources in what people do, and certainly some people have noted that from a sense to get a global picture of how a campaign runs, this is very valuable there. And it might be the kind of thing that might be appropriate to say X amount of years after the election, we're giving this to a presidential library so people can see how these things operated. And quite often you hear about donations to say of big archives and to say, well, this can't be public for 50 years or until everyone mentioned in the archive dies. But in this case, courtesy of the Russian government, we're able to search them almost in real time.
At the end of your article, you invite back channel readers to comment with their thoughts. What kind of reactions have you gotten?
It's run the gamut. Some people, surprisingly, a lot of people have said, look, it's there. There should be no issue at all of mining it because just any reader can go to it. So why should a journalist be restrained? And I understand that. And then other people say that, there is an issue, particularly because of the origin of these emails.
So what do you make of that? I mean, do you think that public opinion is, you know, really a function of demographics, and that people who have grown up in the they're digital natives, they think they're more accepting of this, and maybe someone older who remembers, you know, and in fact, I think there was a lot of shoe leather worn away in the Watergate process. What do you think? Is it an age-related thing?
Well, I don't know. I think some of the comments we got, some people seem to feel that, you know, maybe because John Podesta didn't take every possible precaution, that he had it coming, right? And, you know, I think that's interesting. There's a strain, and I think this is less generational than those with an engineering bent. You know, you hear this sometimes, the saying that, you know, it's up to people to take extra, the highest precautions there. And apparently Podesta did not take advantage of a service that Google offers, which is called two-factor authentication, which basically means that there's an extra protection when someone else gets hold of your email, that Google puts a little text message to you asking, is it okay? So they need not only your password, but your phone in order to get hold of it. But I think when we're talking about, like, the Russians, you know, one of the top intelligence agencies on the planet, you know, trying to get hold of your mail, the precautions that normal people can take or can be overwhelmed there. And I think we should be having a bigger discussion about whether governments, you know, should be involved in stealing these emails here. I know that if the United States was trying to affect an election by stealing emails in another country, many Americans would be critical of the U.S. And, you know, certainly it feels odd and uncomfortable to be rewarding the Russians, if indeed it is the Russians, for this attempt to tilt our election.
Hmm. And what about people? Have they referred to that? Does it matter who the source is? Who the culprits are?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it does matter. On the other hand, and here's where the real dilemma is, that, you know, as I said, news reporters are hardwired to find this information there. And I actually do feel as a reporter, if information is out there, you really should comb it for things like wrongdoing, or things, you know, which feel newsworthy, but mm-hmm. let's say. But of course, you know, where can you draw the line, especially since, you know, everyone can act as a journalist there. So, you know, it feels odd to be sitting there and ignoring certain things when other people can blog it or tweet it who aren't journalists. Nonetheless, I somehow feel that there should be a lot of discussion to figure out where the lines of propriety are here. When you get past the newsworthy stage and into the gossipy stage, where should, you know, top-tier journalists maybe stop in, mm-hmm. you know, writing about that? I'm sort of a relativist about this, and mm-hmm. and feel that in your decision to publish, you know, and if you're working for a major news organization, you know, the source of it should be taken in consideration. It should be a balancing act.
Well, is there any sense that they're having these conversations in newsrooms, that they're having these conversations, say, at Poynter Institute, that ethicists, journalistic ethicists, are talking about this?
Well, in the last week, we've been, you know, sort of people have been waking up like from a hangover, mm-hmm. and saying, gee, what did I do there? What happened there? And I think these questions are being discussed. I hope we contributed to that in a way.
Well, Stephen Levy, thanks for talking about it with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann. Have a great day.
Stephen Levy, editor at backchannel.com. Of course, we'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A decade before the U.S. unveiled the computer network that would bring about what we now call the Internet, Soviet scientists were hard at work on their own system, but their every attempt failed. Professor Benjamin Peters of the University of Tulsa has written a book about that era and a new book entitled How Not to Network a Nation, The Uneasy History of the Soviet Internet. Benjamin Peters, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
This was back when most of us were focused on the arms race and the race to space, the tech race. And the winner was determined less by technology and more by sociology.
That's exactly right. So I think, one of our key instincts when we think about the Cold War is sending rockets into space faster than the next person or building a bigger, faster nuclear program than the next person. But as I think history reveals, a lot of technology ultimately boils down to people, to institutions, and to how our societies are structured. And that's kind of the story that I'm looking to tell today.
Which makes it very, very interesting to me. What was the vision behind the Soviet system? How did they imagine using it?
Yeah, so very different than our own. And in many ways, the uneasy history of the Soviet Internet is a misnomer, of course, because their imagination of a computer network was importantly different than our own, whereas we might point to the U.S. ARPANET being built to initially share research among, sort of build collaborative environments among scientists. There was a number of attempts beginning in 1959, all the way through the collapse of the Soviet Union, to build a national computer network to manage the planned economy better. So this was an attempt to inaugurate an era of electronic socialism, right? Where the computer networks would be used still to make, the market, the planned economy would still be made by state plans and not market prices, but it would all be sped up by, smart computer models and live computer networks that would allow kind of the world of Soviet socialism to unfold in real time with the help of this digital update.
And the idea originally was the brainchild, you wrote, of a Soviet military researcher, Anatoly Ivanovich Kitov. How did his point of view from the military affect his work and what happened to his work?
Yeah. Well, this is one of the great great tensions running throughout the book. Kitov was a young superstar in the military research world, and his proposal in the fall of 1959 was simply to let already pre-existing functioning military computer networks be used to benefit civilian concerns, in particular to let economists kind of step in, and during the nighttime when the generals were sleeping, to use some of this surplus computing power to solve the planned economy issues. As it happened, while he was actually enjoying quite a bit of support from the top political party leaders, his military supervisors absolutely hated this idea, and in fact they had a kind of secret military council where they stripped him of his Communist Party membership and kicked him out of the military for proposing that military resources be used for civilian purposes, and I think that's a kind of a big red flag for me. I hate to kind of be a celebrant of what has been called the military-industrial academic complex in the West, but given Kitov's story, I would say at least if there's a virtue in that in the West, it's the dashes, right? It's the capacity of knowledge and technology to flow from one sector to another, and I think that wasn't possible in Kitov's situation.
Right. I mean, where would we be without Velcro, right? Or space sticks. Tang.
Right,
but it's the same idea, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, that good ideas have legs in places that we don't expect them to. And, I'm certainly not in favor of militarizing anything. But I would be quite happy if some of the research that our kind of militarized state builds could be used for other purposes.
So Kitov's military supervisors find out that he tried to share his thoughts with the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, and they just pretty much unilaterally just stripped him of all of his powers and set him aside.
Yep. He spent the rest of his career working in what they called medical cybernetics or kind of bioinformatics, kind of early, you know, people that would be running our healthcare system today instead.
And it was there, the way their society operated made that okay. Even here, they might say, okay, go off into the civilian sector and do that, but we're going to stay out of our business.
Right, right.
But they didn't
right.
even do that.
Well, no, I mean, he was free to return to the Communist Party later. So it wasn't that he was a non-agent for the rest of his life. But yeah, there was no support or no kind of collaborative possibilities for him in person, which is why his story actually becomes the story of how his idea gets shared with other people,
mm-hmm.
and other people take up his mission and try to take this national civilian network project forward in other ways.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how the Soviets tried and failed a few times to set up their own internet. My guest is Benjamin Peters. He's written a book about this. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, the main person that took up where Kitov left off was Viktor Mikhailovich Glushkov. He started an institute in Kiev in 1962. What were his goals?
Yeah, he had some of the most ambitious, grandiose goals in mind. In fact, let me just tell you the full title of his project. It's been shortened to the OGOS, or the All-State Automated System. In Russian, that's the Obshchoe Государственное Автоматизированное Система. But its full title is even better. It's the All-State Automated System for the Gathering and Processing of Information for the Accounting, Planning, and Governance of the National Economy, USSR. You know, and I think that the title itself kind of speaks to its epic ambitions.
Mm-hmm.
Its goal was to kind of map like a nervous system onto the economic body of the planned economy at the time. It was going to, you know, let the planned economy be processed at the speed of electricity instead of the cumbersome, you know, wrist-bending compendia of paper standards, industry standards, and the rest of it. We could process this by computer. At least that was his hope in the 60s. The vision was... unlike the distributed network design in the West, his was hierarchical but decentralized. So there would be one major computer mother node in Moscow that would spread out to 200 kind of prominent city center computer centers, and then all the way down into the capillaries of as many as 20,000 like local computer centers spread throughout the national economy. And this network would be in live, real time. A way of gathering and processing and improving the economic lifeblood of the Soviet experiment, really.
Now, in just that description, you did compare and contrast a little bit the differences in the technology being pursued by the Soviet Union versus the U.S., right?
Yeah, and there, it's well worth reminding any listeners that we're not talking about you know, laptops or mobile technology or anything like this, but big mainframe computers, which both superpowers had at the time. But this, you're right, the design structure was hierarchically decentralized, and that's important for two reasons. One, it maintains the hierarchical structure of the Soviet state on paper, so it could pass politically, it could be viable, mm-hmm. but it's also decentralized in the sense that Glushkov was not interested in having Moscow run every step for every person. And decentralized in this sense meant that any node on that network could directly connect to one another so long as Moscow had given them permission to. And so there's this kind of like second layer of potential freedom built into his vision. It should be worth pointing out, by the way, that the guy lived in Kiev, which is, you know, a long train ride away from Moscow, and he jokes about having to spend calling his second home the train between Kiev and Moscow. He spent so much time ferrying between the two capitals. So I think he was really personally attuned to what it means to have too much power in one place.
Hmm. And he got his funding how?
Well, he tried, the funding that he did enjoy was thanks to the Soviet Academy of Sciences, where he was a vice president in Ukraine for decades. But his attempt to gain state support failed a number of times. Perhaps the most signal moment of this was on October 1st, 1970, when he had convinced most of the Politburo that it was time to give this all-state automated system a final shakedown and either give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Are we going to fund it or not? And this came a year after the ARPANET in the U.S. was announced as having gone online. So they gathered that day in the Kremlin, and it appeared for a while in the committee notes that things were going well, that they were going to fund this ambitious network economy. But then the Minister of Finance stood up, Vasily Gorbusov, and he... basically, he did not want any competitor ministry to have control over the vast amounts of funding that this project would require. And if they approved it, one of his competitor ministries would have gotten it. So instead, he sort of slyly threatened to submarine the project, and which his Ministry of Finance could do, as in fact they had already done 5 years earlier to a different economic reform project. And you know, it was that kind of turning moment when it was obvious that things fail in committee work. And this is one of the takeaway hard lessons I think of the story, is that sometimes history is contingent, and we can't predict how the world is going to turn out. Maybe a larger point is back to our question about people, mm-hmm. and the social connections between us all. And in this case, you know, it was his social interest. It was in his own self-interest to oppose the OGAS project. That comes up again and again in the history, right? You have lots of people who are actively resisting because it was in their own self-interest to do so.
And which is the great irony, of course.
The great irony, precisely.
Go ahead. The space race that propelled, you know, humans into outer space. What was the difference here? Why weren't they as concerned about beating the U.S. on this note as they were about space and weaponry?
Yeah, that's a great concern. I mean, I think one of the reasons that the space and nuclear weaponry projects enjoy a lot of success is because they are siloed within the military.
Okay.
And a lot of funding could just stay there. And there was no civilian spillover.
Gotcha.
Right? But the question here, I mean, this project becomes so ambitious. It involves educating every factory worker. It involves factory managers. It involves you and me. I mean, just people who would live as social Soviet citizens would begin to need to know how to live in an electronic world. And that has just political complications that are both the potential of our digital moment today as well as its peril when we realize that sometimes what comes to be depends on our social relations instead of the tech potential itself.
So you said what ended Glushkov's efforts was the finance minister, I guess.
Yeah. That's one story.
By the way, how did you get these stories? How did you do your research? Who kept track of this?
Yeah, well, I was at Columbia University fishing for a dissertation project a little less than a decade ago. And, I stumbled upon a footnote in a book I was reading that suggested that the Soviets were working on a unified information network in 1962. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what is this? So I threw myself headlong into it, tried to figure out what the story was there, what had happened. I went to Russia, worked in archives. I speak Russian and knew some people there, but not enough. And I also was introduced to some of the good folks down in Kiev who ended up opening their archives and their people for interviews. So, you know, just the regular historian and dozens of interviews. Is how this story has been told.
How was the U.S. responding to these Soviet efforts? Any sense about that?
Yeah, well, there's some amazing stories here. The moment that JFK was being briefed, he was in a meeting where he was being briefed about the rising peril of Soviet cybernetics. Hmm. Which is precisely what this is. I mean, the backdrop to the network story I'm telling is a story about Soviet cybernetics. And it was in that meeting where you know, CIA specialist was really wringing his hands and worried about, you know, this is going to be the way that they're going to beat us, that meeting was interrupted, in fact, by satellite photos of the Cuban Missile Crisis unfolding. And so that immediately reoriented their attention, took precedent. And by the time they came back, you know, it seemed almost a hidden blessing that no longer was the Kennedy administration really worried about Soviet cybernetics. And it's probably a good thing, too. It doesn't really seem the peril that it today that it did back then.
Mm-hmm. And so Glushkov just went away, or that was it?
Glushkov stuck with it. He's an extraordinary, persistent individual. And just he ended up, I think, tragically and almost fittingly, dying of a brain aneurysm in 1982. But 12 years after, you know, continuing the fight since 1970, so it was his life work to build this OGOS project. And you know, I say fittingly only because, you know, he's the architect of kind of the Soviet economic social nervous system. And it extends too far, and of course that's what his brain aneurysm was too. So he's kind of undone by what he was pursuing. He's a fascinating character. He, you know, once collapsed after working 20-hour days, and then while still strapped to a hospital bed, insisted on finishing his prize-winning book in 1963. You know, just one of these characters who has a vision and a commitment bigger than life itself sometimes.
And again, you call the Soviet fate a clear and present warning to the future of the Internet. You say that we should not take too much comfort from the fact that the global Internet first evolved thanks to cooperative capitalists and not competitive socialists.
Precisely. That's the grand irony, right? So the ARPANET takes shape thanks to collaborative research environments and state subsidy, whereas the Soviet contemporary networks fall apart due to unregulated competition among self-interested institutional infighting. And the takeaway for me is simply that institutions matter, and we need to care about how, as our universities and our state and others are supporting research. I also think it's a reminder that our assumptions about technology will continue to shift. The things that the Soviets assumed about computer networks now seem foreign to us, and that will surely be true in the future as well. And lastly, I think it's a reminder that some of the things we're most concerned about today, you know, maybe even journalism leaks and WikiLeaks, mm-hmm. or the National Security Agency, domestic spying program, or the Microsoft Cloud, or whatever else, all this participates in a much longer 20th century tradition of general secretariats trying to privatize our information for their own gain. So I think it's a way of normalizing and also telling a bigger story about some of the dangers at hand.
Of technology. Benjamin Peters, thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you, Anne. I'm delighted.
Benjamin Peters, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Tulsa, also the author of a new book. It's entitled How Not to Network a Nation, The Uneasy History of the Soviet Internet. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you watched commercial television over the weekend, besides political ads, you probably saw advertisements for the new Google Pixel phone. The Pixel and the Pixel XL, marketed as by Google, have attracted rave reviews and could give iPhones some competition. Here to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, how are these by Google phones different from other Android phones?
Well, in the name you have there, this is something that has been, completely designed to work with the most recent version of Android software. So Google, you know, built features specifically with this hardware in mind, and made sure that this phone worked particularly well with the processor inside. There's you know, some special software, you know, kind of baked into that experience. But really, it's just making sure that this hardware is, you know, kind of exactly what Google wants to see, you know, other smartphone manufacturers, you know, start to look at as quality features in phones.
Okay, so what are some of those features?
So the biggest thing here that you know, kind of stands out is its camera. Google has, you know, worked really hard last year to have a camera that did, you know, just kind of amazing low-light photography, something that, you know, really set itself apart from the other manufacturers. And this year took that same camera and ramped it up so that it is it offers what's called a zero shutter lag experience, which means the second you press the shutter button, the photo is already saved in the photo gallery and is ready to be saved. It's ready to be processed. There's no other things that need to be done, which is difficult to do for a smartphone camera and not something most smartphone cameras are capable of. It also has electronic image stabilization so that you can essentially run down a street with this phone and not notice it when you have the recorded video that you look at later. And you know, the camera quality and the video quality come together to reach something that has been rated by you know, camera experts as one of the best smartphone cameras that have ever existed, which is kind of a weird, lofty thing to say about a smartphone camera when you consider that they're still not quite as good as, you know, a point-and-shoot camera that you would buy in a store. But this is a really great camera that works just very well all the time, and it's kind of fascinating to see.
Yeah, it's just another step in the evolution, right?
Absolutely, yeah. This is a pretty significant you know, step forward, both in low light photography and really just kind of being able to pull your phone out and take a picture no matter where you are. And a big part of that is being able to launch the camera, you know, kind of instantly, mm-hmm. which is something that Samsung had started doing a couple of years ago, where you can double tap the button down at the bottom of the phone.
Right.
And when you press that button twice, it launches the camera. And I've always thought it was kind of weird that nobody else really kind of stepped up and did that. But Google has now implemented with the power button instead of with a separate button. So if you press the power button in twice while the phone is on, then it will launch that camera. Which is nice because it means that you can launch it before you really even have the phone out of your pocket to, you know, to get ready to take that picture.
Does this phone have Google Assistant?
This is the first phone with Google Assistant baked in, and it is it's part of really kind of every bit of the phone. Everywhere that you are in the phone, you can access Google Assistant to do something, which is different from the way that Google Now was used previously in order to build Assistant. You have it built into the home button of the phone, so you can press and hold down on the home button and launch Assistant, or you can just launch it with your voice, you know, even when the screen is off. And Assistant is still very early. It's you know, it does all of the or most of the things that the previous Google Now system does. You can ask, you know, kind of basic questions with the weather and what's on your calendar and you know, what's coming up next on the news or something like that. But you can also kind of thread those conversations, or you can thread those commands into a conversation, which is really kind of interesting in a way that kind of it's weird that it is both more natural and takes some getting used to, because I think most people are kind of programmed themselves to only give one set of instructions to, you know, this kind of software. So it's kind of interesting to talk to it and not think that the next thing you're going to say is going to actually work.
So give me an example of that, you know, of what you mean by all this.
Well, so the quick and easy one is to ask, you know, how's the weather in Maryland? And when you get that response, you can then reply with what about next week or what about tonight?
Without a keyword.
And
yeah.
Without a keyword. So it'll immediately take the information from the previous query and apply it to this. The same goes for information that you have on the screen. If you have maybe someone sent you a movie trailer, you can hold down the home button and say, when is this movie showing in my area? And it will look at the information on the screen and know that that's what you're talking about. You won't have to specifically give the name of the movie or anything like that.
Do you have to pre-program it, like push a button somewhere that says you'll respond to my voice, or does it automatically do that and then you have to default out of it? I mean, does it default to that and then they have to get out of it?
It's kind of both. There is a base system that will respond to your voice when you have it set to do so. But it has a what's called trusted voice mode, which will allow the which will train itself to your voice so that it can work when the display is off. And that requires a little bit of training, just to make sure that your voice is what activates it and not someone else's voice. But then, you know, but if you decide to not ever use that feature, then there are still basic voice commands you can use while the display is on that will that anyone could use to wake up the phone and give commands.
So where does it fall short? Where does it have room to grow, do you think?
Well, it's really just it's kind of basic. The biggest thing that I've seen so far is you can look up something and have the information, you know, on the display for maybe like movie show times, like I just said. But if you say, okay, add that to my calendar, it has no idea what you're talking about and tries to create a new calendar entry with none of the information that you just looked up. And there are a few more examples like that where, you know, the promise of this kind of threaded conversation thing doesn't fully tie in with all of the other Google services yet. So it's still, you know, just kind of very early.
What does it look like?
It's really just a kind of a plain white screen with some bubbles. And the bubbles move to let you know that it is receiving your voice. You know, it'll move, you know, kind of like a voice synth. And then a chat bubble on the left-hand side will show up with answers to whatever command or question you just gave. They've really kind of made it look like a very generic instant messenger feed where it looks like you're actually chatting with the robot in your phone.
We have a call from Bill in Wapakoneta who asks, is it easy to move your contacts, pictures, et cetera, from the iPhone to the new Google phone?
It is. It is really easy to do so depending on how you currently have your iPhone set up. If you've only ever used Apple services, then the quick and easy way to do it is to install the Google app on your iPhone and tell it that you want to back up that information. And then as soon as you have your new phone with Google apps and services, it'll sync all that information over. But there are, you know, other apps that make it very easy to do. It's much easier now both to go to and from an iPhone than I think it's ever been.
How do the Pixel and the Pixel XL differ?
Well, it's really just a very small difference in size. One is a 5-inch screen with a slightly smaller battery, and the other is a 5.5-inch screen with a slightly larger battery and a higher resolution display. But the other inside specs, the processor, the camera, all of those other things are exactly the same.
And is it that noticeable as far as the higher resolution?
No. Because it's a smaller display, the lower resolution is not particularly noticeable. I really think that the only time you would notice the higher resolution on the Pixel XL is when you decide to use the phone in a virtual reality headset or something like that.
Okay. Okay. Let's turn to Nintendo. It's released its first. Let's talk about fun and games. The Nintendo Switch, it's new gaming console. What are your first impressions?
It's really weird, and I want to touch one. those are my first impressions.
Okay, let's get. Can you be more specific?
I can absolutely be more specific. So, Nintendo has been doing this you know kind of fascinating thing for the last couple of generations of their consoles, both the handheld ones and ones that you play on the television, where there's you know kind of more than one screen. You know the Nintendo Wii U was all about having this kind of screen in your hand that worked with the screen on the television, so that you could, you know, kind of have this more immersive gameplay and accomplish some things that you couldn't really do on other systems. And this has now been taken a tremendous step forward in that separate display can actually be its own portable console that you can then pick up and take out of the house and continue playing the game that you were just playing on the television, which is just not been done anywhere before. This is, you know, you have this separate display. It's kind of like a tablet. It really just kind of looks like a blocky tablet, and you set it in the dock when you get home, and now your entire game console is now on the television. But when you want to go out, and if you want to take the game with you, you remove that display and you attach these controller sides to either side of the tablet, and all of your saves, all of your all of the game progress that you've made, the entirety of the experience that you had on the television is now with you when you leave the house.
It's kind of crazy that no one's come up with this before.
Well, it's just been really complicated. I mean, from a technical perspective, you know, when people play these kind of games on television, there's kind of a visual quality that's expected, you know, and then that visual quality consumes an enormous amount of power. And so when you shrink that console experience down to something that's portable, in the past, you would almost need a battery that, you know, you carried along in a backpack in order to get that experience on a screen that you could carry with you. And, you know, what Nintendo is promising here is, the kind of answer to that, where the battery is able to last you a little while so that you can play while you're out, but still get the same, you know, console level visual experience that you expect when you're playing on your television.
Okay, well, which was my next question. Is it the same quality?
Everything that we have seen so far suggests that it is, you know, the same experience when you have it in your hand as when you're playing it on your television.
And
whether that turns out to be true once we actually get to play it is going to be a little different. But Nintendo's been pretty good about, you know, kind of keeping their promises with this kind of thing in the past.
And has anything like this been done before?
Not really. I mean, there have been prototype concepts that have been done with computers, where you have, you know, computer experiences that are handheld, and then you can kind of dock them and they go onto bigger screens. And so you can kind of bring that experience with you in other places, mm-hmm. but never really for a video game console.
So Nintendo really needs to do this well after its last product, the Wii U, flopped. Is it as simple as that? Is they just have to succeed at this or what?
Well, yeah, I mean, the big thing that, you know, Nintendo really needs to pull off here is taking all of the advancements that they've made with the Wii U and deliver on the things that they're promising on here. And then that's going to be a really big deal, because over the last year and a half, the Wii U has really, you know, kind of grown from what it was when it first launched. When it first launched, it really just was not very feature complete, and there was, you know, definitely some problems there. And a lot of that has been changed. You know, they've created full social networks, and the games that have come out have been just incredibly compelling, but they kind of already lost their audience. So a lot of people who were really excited about the things that came along said, well, you know, I'll look forward to doing that on the next thing. And so I think, you know, one of two things is going to happen. They're going to be able to deliver on these promises and offer a brand new Legend of Zelda game when it comes out, which is going to both, you know, kind of pull their entire core audience over, as well as, you know, get new people interested in this kind of cool idea, or they're going to, you know, trip at the beginning again, and it's going to have similar results to the Wii U.
Their strategy, how does it differ from what we're seeing from Xbox and PlayStation?
Well, it seems really like all three of the console manufacturers have different goals right now. Sony is very much into the full immersion. You know, they've stepped up with PlayStation VR.
Yeah.
Where they're all about, you know, kind of being at home and focusing on that. Microsoft is all about creating this unified experience with their PC gaming group, where all of the Xbox native apps and native games can now not only be played on the Xbox, but also be played on a PC or laptop. So that, you know, kind of separate community with PC gaming is now kind of tying together instead of being divided. And Nintendo is making sure that you can have that gaming experience and take it with you wherever you are. So it's really fascinating to see, you know, for the first time in a really long time, just how different these three approaches are.
Any predictions for the coming gift-giving season?
I think Sony is going to continue to do a lot of really interesting things with PlayStation over the year. We saw that they had absolutely no problems making sure that there were plenty of things in stock for the PlayStation launch.
Right.
And that's going to continue into the holiday season. They did a really good job with that. Microsoft has already, you know, made clear what their strategy is for the holiday season. They're going to focus really hard on making sure that there are really exciting new games for all of their existing, for all their existing hardware. And they're not going to talk about new stuff as far as hardware goes until we're into the spring. So really there's not going to be any one like giant new thing this Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be about, getting things to people who hadn't already kind of made the jump.
Russell Holly, thanks a lot for calling us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.